want to go and live in the stupid country, that's all.
I didn't want to leave my home either, but we had to, Olive said. It got smashed by a bomb. The girl's face softened. Mine did too. She put down her suitcase and held out her hand. Sorry I got cross. My name is Jessica. I'm Olive. The two little girls shook hands like gentlemen. I like your blouse, Olive said. Thanks, said Jessica. And I like your... the what's it on your head?
My tiara!
Olive reached up to touch it. It isn't real silver, though. That's okay, it's pretty. Olive smiled as wide as I'd ever seen her smile, and then a loud whistle blew, and a booming voice crackled over a loudspeaker.
All children onto the trains, it said. Nice and orderly now.
The crowd began to flow around us again. Here and there, adults herded the children along, and I heard one say, "Don't worry, you'll see your mummies and daddies again soon." That's when I realized why there were so many children here. They were being evacuated. Of all the many hundreds of kids in the train station this morning, my friends and I were the only ones arriving. The rest were leaving, being shuttled out of the city for their own safety, and from the look of the winter coats and overstuffed cases some of them carried, maybe for a long time.
I have to go, Jessica said,
and Olive had hardly begun to say goodbye when her new friend was borne away by the crowd toward a waiting train. Just that quickly, Olive made and lost the only normal friend she'd ever had. Jessica looked back as she was boarding. Her grim expression seemed to say, "What will become of me?" We watched her go and wondered the same about ourselves. Inside the phone box, Emma scowled at the receiver.
"No one's answering," she said. "All the numbers just ring and ring."
"Last one," said Millard, handing her another ripped-out page. "Cross your fingers."
I was focused on Emma as she dialed, but then a commotion broke out behind me, and I turned to see a crimson-faced man waving an umbrella at us.
"What are you dallying about for?" he said. "Vacate that phone box and board your train at once."
"We just got off one," said Hugh. "We ain't about to get on another."
"And what have you done with your tag numbers?" the man shouted, flecks of spittle flying from his lips. "Produce them at once, or by God I'll have you shipped somewhere a great deal less pleasant than Wales."
"Piss off this instant," said Enoch, "or we'll have you shipped straight to hell."
The man's face went so purple I thought he'd burst a blood vessel in his neck. Clearly, he wasn't used to being spoken to this way by children.
"I said get out of that phone box!" he roared,
and raising the umbrella over his head like an executioner's axe, he brought it down on the cable that stretched between the top of the booth and the wall, snapping it in half with a loud thwack. The phone went dead. Emma looked up from the receiver, boiling with quiet rage.
"If he wants to use the phone so badly," she said, "then let's give it to him."
As she, Millard, and Horace squeezed out of the booth, Bronwyn grabbed the man's hands and pinned them behind his back.
"Stop!"
he screamed.
"Unhand me!"
"Oh, I'll unhand you," said Bronwyn,
and then she picked him up, stuffed him head first into the booth, and barred the door shut with his umbrella. The man screamed and banged on the glass, jumping up and down like a fat fly trapped in a bottle. Although it would have been fun to stick around and laugh at him, the man had drawn too much attention, and now adults were converging on us from all across the station. It was time to go. We linked hands and raced off toward the turnstiles, leaving behind us a wake of tripped and falling normals. A train whistle screeched and was echoed inside Bronwyn's trunk,
where Miss Peregrine was being tossed around like laundry in the wash. Too light on her feet to run, Olive clung to Bronwyn's neck, trailing behind her like a half-deflated balloon on a string. Some of the adults were closer to the exit than we were, and rather than running around them, we tried to barrel straight through. This didn't work. The first to intercept us was a big woman who smacked Enoch upside the head with her purse, then tackled him. When Emma tried to pull her off, two men grabbed her by the arms and wrestled her to the floor. I was about to jump in and help her when a third man grabbed my arms.
"Someone do something!"
Bronwyn cried. We all knew what she meant, but it wasn't clear which of us was free to act. Then a bee whizzed past Enoch's nose and buried its stinger in the haunches of the woman sitting astride him, and she squealed and leapt up.
"Yes!" Enoch shouted. "More bees!" "They're tired!" Hugh shouted back. "They only just got to sleep after saving you the last time!"
But he could see that there was no other way. Emma's arms were pinned. Bronwyn was busy protecting both her trunk and Olive from a trio of angry train conductors, and there were more adults on the way. So Hugh began pounding his chest as if trying to dislodge a piece of stuck food. A moment later, he let out a reverberating belch, and 10 or so bees flew out of his mouth. They did a few circles overhead, then got their bearings and began stinging every adult in sight. The men holding Emma dropped her and fled. The one holding me got stung right on the tip of his nose, and he hollered and flapped his arms as if possessed by demons. Soon, all the adults were running, trying to defend themselves from tiny, stinging attackers with spastic dance moves, to the delight of all the children still on the platform, who laughed and cheered and threw their arms in the air in imitation of their ridiculous elders. With everyone thus distracted, we picked ourselves up, bolted for the turnstiles, and ran out into a bustling London afternoon. We became lost in the chaos of the streets. It felt like we'd been plunged into a jar of stirred liquid, racing with particles. Gentlemen, ladies, laborers, soldiers, street kids, and beggars, all rushing purposefully in every direction, weaving around tiny sputtering cars and cart vendors crying their wares, and buskers blowing horns, and buses blowing horns, and shuddering to stops to spill more people onto the teeming sidewalks. Containing all this was a canyon of column-fronted buildings that stretched to vanishing down a street, half in shadow, the afternoon sun low and muted, reduced by the smokes of London to a murky glow, a lantern winking through fog. Dizzy from it, I half-closed my eyes and let Emma pull me along, while with my free hand I reached into my pocket to touch the cold glass of my phone. I found this strangely calming. My phone was a useless relic of the future, but an object which retained some power nevertheless, that of a long, thin filament connecting this baffling world to the sane and recognizable one I'd once belonged to. A thing that said to me as I touched it, "You are here, and this is real, and you are not dreaming, and you are still you." And somehow that made everything around me vibrate a little less quickly. Enoch had spent his formative years in London and claimed to still know its streets, so he led. We stuck mostly to alleys and back lanes, which made the city seem at first like a maze of gray walls and gutter pipes, its grandness revealed in glimpses as we dashed across wide boulevards and back to the safety of shadows. We made a game of it, laughing, racing one another between alleys. Horace pretended to trip over a curb, then bounced up nimbly and bowed like a dancer, tipping his hat. We laughed like mad, strangely giddy, half in disbelief that we'd made it this far, across the water, through the woods, past snarling hollows and death squads of whites, all the way to London. We put a good long way between us and the train station, and then stopped in an alley by some trash cans to catch our breath. Bronwyn set down her trunk and lifted Miss Peregrine out, and she wobbled drunkenly across the cobblestones. Horace and Millard broke out laughing.
"What's so funny?" said Bronwyn. "It ain't Miss P's fault she's dizzy."
Horace swept his arms out grandly.
"Welcome to beautiful London," he said. "It's ever so much grander than you described it, Enoch. And oh, did you describe it? For 75 years, London, 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 the greatest city on earth."
Millard picked up a trash can lid.
"London, the finest refuse available anywhere."
Horace doffed his hat.
"London, where even the rats wear top hats."
"Oh, I didn't go on about it that much," Enoch said.
"You did," said Olive. "Well, that's not how they do things in London, you'd say. Or, in London, the food is much finer."
"Obviously, we're not on a grand tour of the city right now," Enoch said defensively. "Would you rather walk through alleys or be spotted by whites?" Horace ignored him.
"London, where every day's a holiday. For the trash man!"
He broke down laughing, and his laughter was infectious. Soon, nearly all of us were giggling, even Enoch.
"I suppose I did glamorize it a bit," he admitted.
"I don't see what's so amusing about London," Olive said with a frown. "It's dirty and smelly and full of cruel, nasty people who make children cry, and I hate it."
She scrunched her face into a scowl and added,
"And I'm becoming quite peckish,"
which made us all laugh harder.
"Those people in the station were nasty," said Millard, "but they got what they deserved. I'll never forget that man's face when Bronwyn stuffed him into the phone box."
"Or that horrible woman when she got stung in the bum by a bee," said Enoch. "I'd pay money to see that again."
I glanced at Hugh, expecting him to chime in, but his back was to us, his shoulders trembling. "Hugh?" I said. "You all right?" He shied away.
"No one gives a whit," he said. "Don't bother checking on old Hugh. He's just here to save everyone's hindquarters with no word of thanks from anybody."
Shamed, we offered him our thanks and apologies.
"Sorry, Hugh." "Thanks again, Hugh."
"You're our man in a pinch, Hugh."
He turned to face us.
"They were my friends, you know."
"We still are," said Olive.
"Not you. My bees. They can only sting once, and then it's lights out, the big hive in the sky. And now I've only Henry left, and he can't fly 'cause he's missing a wing."
He put out his hand and slowly opened the fingers, and there in his palm was Henry, waving his only wing at us.
"Come on, mate," Hugh whispered to it. "Time to go home."
He stuck out his tongue, set the bee upon it, and closed his mouth. Enoch patted him on the shoulder.
"I'd bring them back to life for you, but I'm not sure it would work on creatures so small."
"Thanks anyway," Hugh said,
and then he cleared his throat and wiped his cheeks roughly, as if annoyed at his tears for exposing him.
"We'll find you more just as soon as we get Miss P fixed up," said Bronwyn.
"Speaking of which," Enoch said to Emma, "did you manage to get through to any Imbrins on that phone?"
"Not a one,"
Emma replied, then sat down on an overturned trash can, her shoulders slumping.
"I was really hoping we might catch a bit of good luck for once, but no." "Then it seems the dog was correct," said Horace. "The great loops of London have fallen to our enemies."
He bowed his head solemnly.
"The worst has come to pass. All our Imbrins have been kidnapped."
We all bowed our heads, our giddy mood gone.
"In that case," said Enoch, "Millard, You'd better tell us all you know about the punishment loops. If that's where the Imbrins are, we're going to have to stage a rescue.
No, said Millard.
No, no, no.
What do you mean, no? Said Emma.
Millard made a strangled noise in his throat and started breathing weirdly.
I mean, we can't...
He couldn't seem to get the words out.
What's wrong with him? Said Bronwyn.
Mill, what's the matter?
You'd better explain right now what you mean by no,
Emma said threateningly.
Because we'll die, that's why,
Millard said, his voice breaking. But back at the menagerie you made it sound so easy, I said. Like we could just waltz into a punishment loop. Millard was hyperventilating, hysterical, and it scared me. Bronwyn found a crumpled paper bag and told him to breathe into it. When he'd recovered a bit, he answered.
Getting into one is easy enough, he said, speaking slowly, working to control his breaths. Getting out again is trickier. Getting out alive, I should say. Punishment loops are everything the dog said, and worse. Rivers of fire, bloodthirsty Vikings, pestilence so thick you can't breathe. And mixed into all that, like some devilish bouillabaisse, bird knows how many whites and hologast.
Well, that's fantastic, said Horace, tossing up his hands.
You might have told us earlier, you know, like back at the menagerie, when we were planning all this.
Would it have made any difference, Horace?
He took a few more breaths from the bag.
If I'd made it sound more frightening, would you have chosen to simply let Miss Peregrine's humanity expire?
Of course not, said Horace. But you should have told us the truth.
Millard let the bag drop. His strength was returning, and his conviction with it.
I admit I somewhat downplayed the punishment loop's dangers, but I never thought we'd actually have to go into them. Despite all that irritating dog's doomsaying about the state of London, I was certain we'd find at least one unraided loop here, its Imbrins still present and accounted for. And for all we know, we may still. How can we be sure they've all been kidnapped? Have we seen their raided loops with our own eyes? What if the Imbrins' phones were simply disconnected?
All of them?
Enoch scoffed. Even Olive, eternally optimistic Olive, shook her head at that.
Then what do you suggest, Millard? Said Emma. That we tour London's loops and hope to find someone still at home? And what would you say the odds are that the corrupted who are looking for us would leave all those loops unguarded?
I think we'd have a better chance of surviving the night if we spent it playing Russian roulette, said Enoch.
All I mean, Millard said, is that we have no proof.
What more proof do you want? Said Emma. Pools of blood? A pile of plucked Imbrin feathers? Miss Avocet told us the corrupted assault began here weeks ago. Miss Wren clearly believed that all of London's Imbrins had been kidnapped. Do you know better than Miss Wren, an Imbrin herself? And now we're here, and none of the loops are answering their telephones. So please tell me why going loop to loop would be anything other than a suicidally dangerous waste of time.
Wait a minute. That's it, Millard exclaimed.
What about Miss Wren?
What about her? Said Emma.
Don't you remember what the dog told us? Miss Wren came to London a few days ago when she heard that her sister Imbrins had been kidnapped.
So?
What if she's still here? Then she's probably been captured by now, said Enoch.
And if she hasn't?
Millard's voice was bright with hope.
She could help Miss Peregrine, and then we wouldn't have to go anywhere near the punishment loops.
And how would you suggest we find her?
Enoch said shrilly.
Shout her name from the rooftops? This isn't Cairnholm. It's a city of millions.
Her pigeons, said Millard.
Come again? It was Miss Wren's peculiar pigeons who told her where the Imbrins had been taken. If they knew where all the other Imbrins went, then they should know where Miss Wren is, too. They belong to her, after all.
Ha! Said Enoch. The only thing commoner here than plain-looking middle-aged ladies are flocks of pigeons. And you want to search all of London for one flock in particular?
It does seem a bit mad, Emma said. Sorry, Mill, I just don't see how that could work.
Then it's a lucky thing for you I spent our train ride studying rather than making idle gossip. Someone hand me the tales!
Bronwyn fished the book from her trunk and gave it to him. Millard dove right in, flipping pages.
There are many answers to be found within, he said, if you only know what to look for.
He stopped at a certain page and stabbed the top with his finger.
Aha!
He said, turning the book to show us what he'd found. The title of the story was The Pigeons of St. Paul's.
I'll be blessed, said Bronwyn. Could those be the same pigeons we're talking about?
If they're written about in the tales, they're almost certainly peculiar pigeons, said Millard.
And how many flocks of peculiar pigeons could there possibly be?
Olive clapped her hands and cried,
Millard, you're brilliant!
Thank you, yes, I was aware.
Wait, I'm lost, I said. What's St. Paul's?
Even I know that, said Olive. The cathedral!
And she went to the end of the alley and pointed up at a giant domed roof rising in the distance.
It's the largest and most magnificent cathedral in London, said Millard. And if my hunch is correct, it's also the nesting place of Miss Wren's pigeons.
Let's hope they're at home, said Emma, and that they've got some good news for us. We've had quite a drought of it lately.
As we navigated a labyrinth of narrow streets toward the cathedral, a brooding quiet settled over us. For long stretches, no one spoke, leaving only the tap of our shoes on pavement and the sounds of the city, airplanes, the ever-present hum of traffic, sirens that warbled and pitch-shifted around us. The farther we got from the train station, the more evidence we saw of the bombs that had been raining down on London. Building fronts pocked by shrapnel, shattered windows, streets that glinted with frosts of powdered glass. The sky was speckled with puffy silver blimps tethered to the ground by long webs of cable.
Barrage balloons, Emma said, when she saw me craning my neck toward one. The German bombers get caught up in their cables at night and crash.
Then we came upon a scene of destruction so bizarre that I had to stop and gape at it. Not out of some morbid voyeurism, but because it was impossible for my brain to process without further study. A bomb crater yawned across the whole width of the street, like a monstrous mouth with broken pavement for teeth. At one edge, the blast had sheared away the front wall of a building, but left what was inside mostly intact. It looked like a doll's house, its interior rooms all exposed to the street, the dining room with its table still set for a meal, family pictures knocked crooked in a hallway but still hanging, a roll of toilet paper unspooled and caught in the breeze, waving in the air like a long white flag.
"Did they forget to finish building it?" Olive asked.
"No, dummy," said Enoch. "It got hit by a bomb."
For a moment, Olive looked as if she might cry, but then her face went hard and she shook her fist at the sky and yelled,
"Nasty Hitler! Stop this horrible war and go right away all together!"
Bronwyn patted her arm.
"Shh! He can't hear you, love."
"It isn't fair," Olive said. "I'm tired of airplanes and bombs and war."
"We all are," said Enoch. "Even me."
Then I heard Horace scream, and I spun around to see him pointing at something in the road. I ran to see what it was, and then I did see. and I stopped, frozen, my brain shouting, "Run away!" but my legs refusing to listen. It was a pyramid of heads. They were blackened and caved, mouths agape, eyes boiled shut, melted and pooled together in the gutter like some hydra-headed horror. Then Emma came to see, and gasped and turned away. Bronwyn came and started moaning. Hugh gagged and clapped his hands over his eyes, and then finally Enoch, who seemed not in the least disturbed, calmly nudged one of the heads with his shoe and pointed out that they were only mannequins made of wax, having spilled from the display window of a bombed wig shop. We all felt a little ridiculous, but somehow no less horrified, because even though the heads weren't real, they represented something that was, hidden beneath the rubble around us. "Let's go," Emma said. "This place is nothing but a graveyard." We walked on. I tried to keep my eyes to the ground, but there was no shutting out all the ghastly things we passed. A scarred ruin belching smoke, the only fireman dispatched to extinguish it slouched in defeat, blistered and weary, his hose run dry. Yet there he stood, watching anyway, as if, lacking water, his job now was to bear witness. A baby in a stroller, left alone in the street, bawling. Bronwyn slowed, overcome.
"Can't we help them somehow?"
"It wouldn't make any difference," said Millard. "These people belong to the past, and the past can't be changed."
Bronwyn nodded sadly. She'd known it was true, but had needed to hear it said. We were barely here, ineffectual as ghosts. A cloud of ash billowed, blotting out fireman and child. We went on, choking in an eddy of wind-borne wreck dust, powdered concrete blanching our clothes, our faces bone white. We hurried past the ruined blocks as quickly as we could, then marveled as the streets returned to life around us. Just a short walk from hell, people were going about their business, striding down sidewalks, living in buildings that still had electricity, and windows, and walls. Then we rounded a corner and the cathedral's dome revealed itself, proud and imposing despite patches of fire-blackened stone and a few crumbling arches. Like the spirit of the city itself, it would take more than a few bombs to topple St. Paul's. Our hunt began in a square close to the cathedral, where old men on benches were feeding pigeons. At first it was mayhem. We bounded in, grabbing wildly as the pigeons took off. The old men grumbled, and we withdrew to wait for their return. They did, eventually, pigeons not being the smartest animals on the planet, at which point we all took turns wading casually into the flock and trying to catch them by surprise, reaching down to snatch at them. I thought Olive, who was small and quick, or Hugh, with his peculiar connection to another sort of winged creature, might have some luck, but both were humiliated. Miller didn't fare any better, and they couldn't even see him. By the time my turn came, the pigeons must have been sick of us bothering them, because the moment I strolled into the square, they all burst into flight and took one big simultaneous cluster bomb crap, which sent me flailing toward a water fountain to wash my whole head. In the end, it was Horace who caught one. He sat down next to the old men, dropping seeds until the birds circled him. Then, leaning slowly forward, he stretched out his arm and, calm as could be, snagged one by its feet.
"Got you!"
he cried. The bird flapped and tried to get away, but Horace held on tight. He brought it to us.
"How can we tell if it's peculiar?" he said, flipping the bird over to inspect its bottom, as if expecting to find a label there.
"Show it to Miss Peregrine," Emma said. "She'll know."
So we opened Bronwyn's trunk, shoved the pigeon inside with Miss Peregrine, and slammed down the lid. The pigeon screeched like it was being torn apart. I winced and shouted, "Go easy, Miss P!" When Bronwyn opened the trunk again, a poof of pigeon feathers fluttered into the air, but the pigeon itself was nowhere to be seen.
"Oh, no! She's ate it!" cried Bronwyn.
"No, she hasn't," said Emma. "Look beneath her!"
Miss Peregrine lifted up and stepped aside, and there underneath her was the pigeon, alive but dazed.
"Well," said Enoch, "is it or isn't it one of Miss Wren's?"
Miss Peregrine nudged the bird with her beak, and it flew away. Then she leapt out of the trunk, hobbled into the square, and with one loud squawk scattered the rest of the pigeons. Her message was clear. Not only was Horace's pigeon not peculiar, none of them were. We'd have to keep looking. Miss Peregrine hopped toward the cathedral and flapped her wing impatiently. We caught up to her on the cathedral steps. The building loomed above us, soaring bell towers framing its giant dome. An army of soot-stained angels glared down at us from marble reliefs. "How are we ever going to search this whole place?" I wondered aloud.
"One room at a time," Emma said.
A strange noise stopped us at the door. It sounded like a faraway car alarm, the note pitching up and down in long, slow arcs. But there were no car alarms in 1940, of course. It was an air raid siren. Horace cringed.
"The Germans are coming!" he cried. "Death from the skies!"
"We don't know what it means," Emma said. "Could be a false alarm or a test."
But the streets and the square were emptying fast. The old men were folding up their newspapers and vacating their benches.
"They don't seem to think it's a test," Horace said.
"Since when are we afraid of a few bombs?" Enoch said.
"Quit talking like a Nazi normal."
"Need I remind you," said Millard, "these are not the sort of bombs we're accustomed to. Unlike the ones that fall on Cairnholm, we don't know where they're going to land."
"All the more reason to get what we came for, and quickly," Emma said,
and she led us inside. The cathedral's interior was massive. It seemed impossibly even larger than the outside. And though damaged, a few hardy believers knelt here and there in silent prayer. The altar was buried under a midden of debris. Where a bomb had pierced the roof, sunlight fell down in broad beams. A lone soldier sat on a fallen pillar, gazing at the sky through the broken ceiling. We wandered, necks craned, bits of concrete and broken tile crunching beneath our feet.
"I don't see anything,"
Horace complained.
"There are enough hiding places here for 10,000 pigeons."
"Don't look," Hugh said.
"Listen."
We stopped, straining to hear the telltale coo of pigeons, but there was only the ceaseless whine of air raid sirens, and below that, a series of dull cracks like rolling thunder. I told myself to stay calm, but my heart thrummed like a drum machine. Bombs were falling.
"We need to go," I said, panic choking me. "There has to be a shelter nearby, somewhere safe we can hide."
"But we're so close," said Bronwyn. "We can't quit now."
There was another crack, closer this time, and the others started to get nervous too.
"Maybe Jacob's right," said Horace. "Let's find somewhere safe to hide until the bombing's through. We can search more when it's over."
"Nowhere is truly safe," said Enoch. "Those bombs can penetrate even a deep shelter."
"They can't penetrate a loop," Emma said. "And if there's a tale about this cathedral, there's probably a loop entrance here too."
"Perhaps," said Millard. "Perhaps, perhaps. Hand me the book, and I shall investigate."
Bronwyn opened her trunk and handed Millard the book.
"Let me see now,"
he said, turning its pages until he reached the pigeons of St. Paul's. Bombs are falling and we're reading stories, I thought. I have entered the realm of the insane.
Listen closely, Millard said. If there's a loop entrance nearby, this tale may tell us how to find it. It's a short one, luckily.
A bomb fell outside. The floor shook and plaster rained from the ceiling. I clenched my teeth and tried to focus on my breathing. Unfazed, Millard cleared his throat.
"The pigeons of St. Paul's," he began, reading in a big, booming voice. "We know the title already," said Enoch. "Read faster, please," said Bronwyn.
"If you don't stop interrupting me, we'll be here all night," said Millard, and then he continued.
"Once upon a peculiar time, long before there were towers or steeples or any tall buildings at all in the city of London, there was a flock of pigeons who got it into their minds that they wanted a nice, high place to roost, above the bustle and fracas of human society. They knew just how to build it, too, because pigeons are builders by nature, and much more intelligent than we give them credit for being. But the people of ancient London weren't interested in constructing tall things, so one night the pigeons snuck into the bedroom of the most industrious human they could find, and whispered into his ears the plans for a magnificent tower. In the morning, the man awoke in great excitement. He had dreamed, or so he thought, of a magnificent church with a great reaching spire that would rise from the city's tallest hill. A few years later, at enormous cost to the humans, it was built. It was a very towering sort of tower and had all manner of nooks and crannies inside it where the pigeons could roost, and they were very satisfied with themselves. Then one day, Vikings sacked the city and burned the tower to the ground, so the pigeons had to find another architect, whisper in his ear, and wait patiently for a new church tower to be built. This one even grander and taller than the first. And it was built, and it was very grand and very tall. And then it burned too. Things went on in this fashion for hundreds of years, the towers burning and the pigeons whispering plans for still grander and taller towers to successive generations of nocturnally inspired architects. Though these architects never realized the debt they owed the birds, they still regarded them with tenderness and allowed them to hang about wherever they liked, in the naves and belfries, like the mascots and guardians of the place they truly were.
"This is not helpful," Enoch said. "Get to the loop entrance part." "I am getting to what I am getting to," Millard snapped.
Eventually, after many church towers had come and gone, the pigeons' plans became so ambitious that it took an exceedingly long time to find a human intelligent enough to carry them out. When they finally did, the man resisted, believing the hill to be cursed, so many churches having burned there in the past. Though he tried to put the idea out of his mind, the pigeons kept returning, night after night, to whisper it in his ear. Still, the man would not act. So they came to him during the day, which they had never done before, and told him in their strange laughing language that he was the only human capable of constructing their tower, and he simply had to do it. But he refused, and chased them from his house, shouting, "Shoo, begone with ye, filthy creatures!" The pigeons, insulted and vengeful, hounded the man until he was nearly mad, following him wherever he went, picking at his clothes, pulling his hair, fouling his food with their hind feathers, tapping on his windows at night so he couldn't sleep, until one day he fell to his knees and cried, "Oh, pigeons, I will build whatever you ask so long as you watch over it and preserve it from the fire." The pigeons puzzled over this. Consulting among themselves, they decided that they might have been better guardians of past towers if they hadn't come to enjoy building them so much, and vowed to do everything they could to protect them in the future. So the man built it, a soaring cathedral with two towers and a dome. It was so grand, and both the man and the pigeons were so pleased with what they'd made, that they became great friends.
The man never went anywhere for the rest of his life without a pigeon close at hand to advise him. Even after he died at a ripe and happy old age, the bird still went to visit him, now and again, in the land below. And to this very day, you'll find the cathedral they built standing on the tallest hill in London, the pigeons watching over it. Millard closed the book. The end. Emma made an exasperated noise.
Yes, but watching over it from where?
That could not have been less helpful to our present situation, said Enoch, were it a story about cats on the moon.
I can't make heads or tails of it, said Bronwyn. Can anyone?
I nearly could, felt close to something in that line about the land below, but all I could think was, the pigeons are in hell? Then another bomb fell, shaking the whole building, and from high overhead came a sudden flutter of wing beats. We looked up to see three frightened pigeons shoot out of some hiding place in the rafters. Miss Peregrine squawked with excitement, as if to say, "That's them!" And Bronwyn scooped her up, and we all went racing after the birds. They flew down the length of the nave, turned sharply, and disappeared through a doorway. We reached the doorway a few seconds later. To my relief, it didn't lead outside, where we'd never have a hope of catching them, but to a stairwell, down a set of spiral steps.
"Ha!"
Enoch said, clapping his pudgy hands.
"They've gone and done it now! Trap themselves in the basement!"
We sprinted down the stairs. At the bottom was a large, dimly lit room, walled and floored with stone. It was cold and damp and almost completely dark, the electricity having been knocked out, so Emma sparked a flame in her hand and shone it around, until the nature of the space became apparent. Beneath our feet, stretching from wall to wall, were marble slabs, chiseled with writing. The one below me read, "Bishop Eldridge Thornbrush, died anno 1721.
"This is no basement," Emma said. "It's a crypt."
A little chill came over me, and I stepped closer to the light and warmth of Emma's flame.
"You mean there are people buried in the floor?" said Olive, her voice quavering.
"What of it?" said Enoch.
"Let's catch a damned pigeon before one of those bombs buries us in the floor."
Emma turned in a circle, throwing light on the walls.
"They've got to be down here somewhere. There's no way out but that staircase."
Then we heard a wing flap. I tensed. Emma brightened her flame and aimed it toward the sound. Her flickering light fell on a flat-topped tomb that rose a few feet from the floor. Between the tomb and the wall was a gap we couldn't see behind from where we stood. A perfect hiding spot for a bird. Emma raised a finger to her lips and motioned for us to follow. We crept across the room. Nearing the tomb, we spread out, surrounding it on three sides.
"Ready,"
Emma mouthed. The others nodded. I gave a thumbs up. Emma tiptoed forward to peek behind the tomb, and then her face fell.
"Nothing,"
she said, kicking the floor in frustration.
"I don't understand," said Enoch. "They were right here."
We all came forward to look. Then Millard said,
"Emma, shine your light on top of the tomb, please."
She did, and Millard read the tomb's inscription aloud.
"Here lieth Sir Christopher Wren, builder of this cathedral."
"Wren!" Emma exclaimed. "What an odd coincidence!"
"I hardly think it's a coincidence," said Millard. "He must be related to Miss Wren. Perhaps he's her father."
"That's very interesting," said Enoch. "But how does that help us find her or her pigeons?"
"That is what I am attempting to puzzle out."
Millard hummed to himself and paced a little and recited a line from the tale. "The bird still went to visit him, now and again, and the land below." Then I thought I heard a pigeon coo. I said, and made everyone listen. It came again a few seconds later from the rear corner of the tomb. I circled around it and knelt down, and that's when I noticed a small hole in the floor at the tomb's base, no bigger than a fist, just large enough for a bird to wriggle through.
"Over here," I said.
"Well, I'll be stuffed," said Emma, holding her flame up to the hole. "Perhaps that's the land below?"
"But the hole is so small," said Olive. "How are we supposed to get the birds out of there?"
"We could wait for them to leave," said Horace, and then a bomb fell so close by that my eyes blurred and my teeth rattled.
"No need for that," said Millard. "Bronwyn, would you please open Sir Wren's tomb?"
"No," cried Olive. "I don't want to see his rotten old bones."
"Don't worry, love," Bronwyn said. "Millard knows what he's doing." She planted her hands on the edge of the tomb lid and began to push, and it slid open with a slow, grating rumble. The smell that came up wasn't what I'd expected, not of death, but mold and old dirt. We gathered around to look inside.
"Well, I'll be stuffed," Emma said.
Chapter 9. Where a coffin should have been, there was a ladder leading down into darkness. We peered into the open tomb.
"There's no way I'm climbing down there," Horace said.
But then a trio of bombs shook the building, raining chips of concrete on our heads, and suddenly Horace was pushing past me, grasping for the ladder.
"Excuse me, out of my way, best dressed goes first."
Emma caught him by the sleeve.
"I have the light, so I'll go first. Then Jacob will follow in case there are things down there."
I flashed a weak smile, my knees going wobbly at the thought. Enoch said,
"You mean things other than rats and cholera and whatever sorts of mad trolls live beneath crypts?"
"It doesn't matter what's down there," Millard said grimly. "We'll have to face it. And that's that."
"Fine," said Enoch. "But Miss Wren had better be down there too, because rat bites don't heal quickly."
"Hologast bites even less so," said Emma,
and then she swung her foot onto the ladder. "Be careful," I said. "I'll be right above you." She saluted me with her flaming hand.
"Once more into the breach," she said,
and began to climb down. Then it was my turn. "Do you ever find yourself climbing into an open grave during a bombing raid?" I said, "and just wish you'd stayed in bed." Enoch kicked my shoe.
"Quit stalling."
I grabbed the lip of the tomb and put my foot on the ladder. Thought briefly of all the pleasant, boring things I might have been doing with my summer had my life gone differently. Tennis camp, sailing lessons, stocking shelves, and then, through some Herculean effort of will, I made myself climb. The ladder descended into a tunnel. The tunnel dead-ended to one side, and in the other direction, disappeared into blackness. The air was cold and suffused with a strange odor, like clothes left to rot in a flooded basement. The rough stone walls beaded and dripped with moisture of mysterious origin. As Emma and I waited for everyone to climb down, the cold crept into me, degree by degree. The others felt it, too. When Bronwyn reached the bottom, she opened her trunk and handed out the peculiar sheep's wool sweaters we'd been given in the menagerie. I slipped one over my head. It fit me like a sack, the sleeves falling past my fingers and the bottom sagging halfway to my knees, but at least it was warm. Bronwyn's trunk was empty now, and she left it behind. Miss Peregrine rode inside her coat, where she'd practically made a nest for herself. Millard insisted on carrying the tails in his arms, heavy and bulky as it was, because he might need to refer to it at any moment, he said. I think it had become his security blanket, though, and he thought of it as a book of spells, which only he knew how to read. We were an odd bunch. I shuffled forward to feel for hollows in the dark. This time I got a new kind of twinge in my gut, ever so faint, as if a hollow had been here and gone, and I was sensing its residue. I didn't mention it, though. There was no reason to alarm everyone unnecessarily. We walked. The sound of our feet slapping the wet bricks echoed endlessly up and down the passage. There'd be no sneaking up on whatever was waiting for us. Every so often, from up ahead, we'd hear a flap of wings or a pigeon's warble, and we'd pick up our pace a little. I got the uneasy feeling we were being led toward some nasty surprise. Embedded in the walls were stone slabs like the ones we'd seen in the crypt, but older, the writing mostly worn away. Then we passed a coffin, graveless, on the floor. Then, a whole stack of them, leaned against a wall like discarded moving boxes.
"What is this place?"
Hugh whispered.
"Graveyard overflow," said Enoch. "When they need to make room for new customers, they dig up the old ones and stick them down here."
"What a terrible loop entrance," I said. "Imagine walking through here every time you needed in or out."
"It's not so different from our cairn tunnel," Millard said. "Unpleasant loop entrances serve a purpose. Normals tend to avoid them, so we peculiars have them all to ourselves."
So rational, so wise. All I could think was, there are dead people everywhere, and they're all rotted and bony and dead and, oh, God.
"Uh-oh,"
Emma said, and she stopped suddenly, causing me to run into her and everyone else to pile up behind me. She held her flame to one side, revealing a curved door in the wall. It hung open slightly, but only darkness showed through the crack. We listened. For a long moment, there was no sound but our breath and the distant drip of water. Then we heard a noise, but not the kind we were expecting. Not a wing flap or the scratch of a bird's feet, but something human. Very softly, someone was crying.
"Hello?" called Emma. "Who's in there?"
"Please don't hurt me,"
came an echoing voice. Or was it a pair of voices? Emma brightened her flame. Bronwyn crept forward and nudged the door with her foot. It swung open to expose a small chamber filled with bones. Femurs, shin bones, skulls, the dismembered fossils of many hundreds of people, heaped up in no apparent order. I stumbled backward, dizzy with shock.
"Hello?" Emma said. "Who said that? Show yourself!"
At first I couldn't see anything in there but bones. But then I heard a sniffle, and followed the sound to the top of the pile, where two pairs of eyes blinked at us from the murky shadows at the rear of the chamber.
"There's no one here," said a small voice. "Go away," came a second voice. "We're dead."
"No, you're not," said Enoch, "and I would know."
"Come out of there," Emma said gently. "We're not going to hurt you."
Both voices said at once,
"Promise?"
"We promise," said Emma.
The bones began to shift. A skull dislodged from the pile and clattered to the floor, where it rolled to a stop at my feet and stared up at me. "Hello, future," I thought. Then two young boys crawled into the light on hands and knees atop the bone pile. Their skin was deathly pale, and they peeped at us with black circled eyes that wheeled dizzyingly in their sockets.
"I'm Emma. This is Jacob, and these are our friends," Emma said. "We're peculiar, and we're not going to hurt you."
The boys crouched like frightened animals, saying nothing,
eyes spinning, seeming to look everywhere and nowhere.
"What's wrong with them?"
Olive whispered. Bronwyn hushed her.
"Don't be rude."
"Can you tell me your names?" Emma said, her voice coaxing and gentle.
"I am Joel and Peter," the larger boy said.
"Which are you?" Emma said. "Joel or Peter?"
"I am Peter and Joel," said the smaller boy.
"We don't have time for games," said Enoch. "Are there any birds in there with you? Have you seen any fly past?"
"The pigeons like to hide," said the larger.
"In the attic," said the smaller.
"What attic?" said Emma. "Where?"
"In our house,"
they said together, and raising their arms they pointed down the dark passage. They seemed to speak cooperatively, and if a sentence was more than a few words long, one would start and the other finish, with no detectable pause between. I also noticed that whenever one was speaking and the other wasn't, the quiet one would mouth the other's words in perfect synchronicity, as if they shared one mind.
"Could you please show us the way to your house?" asked Emma. "Take us to your attic?"
Joel and Peter shook their heads and shrank back into the dark.
"What's the matter?" Bronwyn said. "Why don't you want to go?"
"Death and blood!" cried one boy. "Blood and screaming!" cried the other. "Screaming and blood and shadows that bite!"
they cried together.
"Cheerio!" said Horace, turning on his heels. "I'll see you all back in the crypt. Hope I don't get squashed by a bomb."
Emma caught Horace by his sleeve.
"Oh, no, you don't. You're the only one of us who's managed to catch any of those blasted pigeons."
"Didn't you hear them?" Horace said. "That loop is full of shadows that bite, which could only mean one thing. Hollows."
"It was full of them," I said. "But that might have been days ago."
"When was the last time you were inside your house?" Emma asked the boys.
Their loop had been raided, they explained in their strange and broken way, but they'd managed to escape into the catacombs and hide among the bones. How long ago that was, they couldn't say. 2 days? 3? They'd lost all track of time down here in the dark.
"Oh, you poor dears," said Bronwyn. "What terrors you must have endured!"
"You can't stay here forever," said Emma. "You'll age forward if you don't reach another loop soon. We can help you, but first we have to catch a pigeon."
The boys gazed into one another's spinning eyes and seemed to speak without uttering a word. They said in unison,
"Follow us."
They slid down from their bone pile and started down the passage. We followed. I couldn't take my eyes off them. They were fascinatingly odd. They kept their arms linked at all times, and every few steps they made loud clicking sounds with their tongues.
"What are they doing?" I whispered. "I believe that's how they see," said Millard. "It's the same way bats see in the dark. The sounds they make reflect off things and then back to them, which forms a picture in their minds."
"We are echolocators," Joel and Peter said.
They were also, apparently, very sharp of hearing. The passage forked, then forked again. At one point I felt a sudden pressure in my ears and had to wiggle them to release it. That's when I knew we'd left 1940 and entered a loop. Finally, we came to a dead-end wall with vertical steps cut into it. Joel and Peter stood at the base of the wall and pointed to a pinpoint of daylight overhead.
"Our house," said the elder. "Is up there," said the younger.
And with that, they retreated into the shadows. The steps were slimed with moss and difficult to climb, and I had to go slowly or risk falling. They ascended the wall to meet a circular person-sized door in the ceiling,
through which shone a single gleam of light. I wedged my fingers into the crack and pushed sideways, and the doors slid open like a camera shutter, revealing a tubular conduit of bricks that rose 20 or 30 feet to a circle of sky.